In a divided 5-4 decision yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that an upstate New York town did not violate the Constitution by starting its public meetings with a prayer. Two residents of the town of Greece had sued, saying the prayers ran afoul of the First Amendment's prohibition of government establishment of religion. Town officials said that members of all faiths were welcome to give the opening prayer, although in practice almost all the prayers were Christian. Writing for the majority, Justice Anthony Kennedy said the prayers were merely ceremonial and neither unduly sectarian nor likely to make members of other faiths feel unwelcome. Patrick Gary is a USD law professor who's explored religion and the courts in the book Wrestling with God, The Court's Tortuous Treatment of Religion. The book was cited in a brief submitted to the Supreme Court in this case, Greece versus Galloway. He's with us here in the studio in Vermilion. Patrick, welcome back to Dakota Midday.
Thanks, Carl.
For a little background, what was this case about, Greece versus Galloway?
It was about a prayer and a prayer practice that the town of Greece had. The practice was that it would open its monthly town board meetings with a prayer by what they called a volunteer chaplain of the month. And this would be anybody from the community that wanted to deliver this prayer or this invocation prior to the town board or town council meeting. It was primarily a Christian town, a Christian community, so most of the prayer givers were Christian. There was a complaint made eventually by what were to be the plaintiffs in this case and about being offended by the prayers and objecting to the prayers in the town, then took efforts to try to bring in people of different faith traditions. And in fact, they had then a number of non-Christian prayer leaders then offer these prayers. But subsequently, this suit took place, and then it went obviously from the district court level up to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, and then finally the Supreme Court.
Now, this goes back, or I'm wondering if the arguments made in this case are if they're essentially the same in the 1983 court case, Marsh versus Chamber. There, the Supreme Court ruled they upheld a Nebraska legislator's practice of opening with an invocation from a minister. Is this essentially the same arguments here, or are there other things involved in this case, Greece versus Galloway?
Yeah, this case did turn almost directly upon Marsh versus Chambers, a 1983 case where the Supreme Court upheld the Nebraska practice of opening its state legislative sessions with a prayer by a state paid chaplain. Now, there's a difference there because that was obviously a chaplain on the state payroll. Here, it was just a volunteer from the community. The Second Circuit, the Court of Appeals, overturned this prayer practice, and there it used the endorsement test, another sort of test that the court has used to determine whether an establishment of religion has occurred. It did not use the Marsh versus Chambers test, even though the Marsh versus Chambers test is probably the most directly on point. And in fact, the Supreme Court then came back to this test, this Marsh versus Chambers, arguing about whether this test then would uphold or strike down this prayer practice. And both the court and the dissent disagreed on that.
So how does what is the endorsement test?
The endorsement test essentially looks at as to whether a reasonable observer would think that the government was endorsing a religion through its practice. So in other words, in this case, would a reasonable observer sort of in the town board meeting or in the town at all sort of think that this practice of opening a town board meeting with a prayer, would that be an endorsement and hence an establishment of religion? So the focus of the endorsement test is really on the effect on the listener. What would a listener perceive? The focus in the Marsh versus Chambers test is really on history. What does history tell us? Marsh versus Chambers says that if a practice occurred at the time that the First Amendment was drafted and ratified, then that must not be a establishment of religion because it was well known and well used at the time, and hence the framers and ratifiers did not consider it to be an establishment of religion.
And that was essentially Justice Kennedy's argument in writing for the majority in this case, that this is just part of the ceremonial practice, the tradition of the U.S.?
A large part of Justice Kennedy's opinion focused on history and what kind of prayers occurred at the time of and preceding the ratification of the First Amendment. and that these prayers were sort of long and historical precedent that were not outlawed or prohibited by the First Amendment. That's what his focus on was, on history. I think if you look at the dissent, the focus there is very much on sort of the looking very much at the content of the prayers and analyzing what effect they could have on people in the audience, for instance, who would be either find objection to or find offense at those prayers.
One of the arguments in this case, in comparison to the Marsh versus Chambers, was that this case dealt with a town meeting, while the other one was with the legislature. And with the town meeting, you would have citizens who were talking with officials trying to gain favor or, you know, have certain things that they wanted done by the town council. And that made the context of the prayer a little bit different.
Yeah, there was a lot of debate leading up to this case as to whether that might be a big difference. In other words, a state legislature is different than a local town board or town council, that sort of thing, and different in terms of who's there and who's present, what types of members of the public are there. That had some – the court addressed that, but not nearly so much as what some of the lead-up arguments to it. Instead, the court really focused on the key issue that it seemed to focus on arising out of this Marsh versus Chambers test was – did Marsh versus Chambers require that the prayers be non-sectarian, or could the prayers be even sectarian and still pass the Marsh versus Chambers test? That was maybe the big issue there that was argued between the opinions.
The aspect of the prayers being ceremonial, it seems almost that maybe Justice Kennedy is defining what prayers are. Within this context, if you're just saying they're ceremonial, that they don't really have much more of a meaning beyond that?
I think what he's doing by saying they're ceremonial is that if you read the opinion, he tends to say that prayers that occur at the beginning of a meeting are in this case, okay. Prayers might be problematic if somehow the prayers are tied with particular policy discussions, like if we're going to pass some kind of environmental type of ordinance, are we going to pray for that and direct our prayers sort of at that with respect to it? So I think with ceremonial, he just he means it by saying that prayers have a very historical role, that they've historically played this kind of ceremonial purpose. But Justice Kennedy actually then tries not to look at the content of the prayers. And in doing so, he says we're not going to draw a line between sectarian prayers and non-sectarian prayers because that would involve the court too much in terms of like parsing and dissecting the content of the prayer, whereas the dissent does look more at the content of the prayers and, again, at the effect that that content might have. So I think Justice Kennedy tries to stay away from looking at the content. He tends to talk about ceremonial in terms of they have a historic ceremonial purpose that oftentimes the public has opened public events from in a kind of ceremonial context of giving a prayer at the beginning of it. So he I think uses the word ceremonial to describe the historic role of prayers, but not their content.
Could this lead to a case in the future where prayers will need to be defined? I believe Kennedy suggested that prayers may be unacceptable if they denigrate non-believers or religious minorities or threaten damnation or preach conversion. If something like that actually happened in a prayer, could there be a court case and then we would have to be in a situation where prayers would need to be defined in this context of in a public sphere?
Right. What Justice Kennedy, again, tries to do is keep the court out of it. And he says that at several points in his opinion, keep the court out of monitoring the content of prayers. But he does put some parameters on it. Just like the Marsh versus Chambers test, that case back in 1983 gave the okay to legislative prayer, it put some exceptions on it. Now Justice Kennedy sort of refined those exceptions. One of those, just as you mentioned, was they can't be used to essentially give preferences to denigrate or discriminate against other religions. So, sure, cases could come up again in which these kinds of parameters that Justice Kennedy sets forth aren't met by a particular prayer.
It almost sounds that maybe the court is, in this ruling, the majority is stepping back from enforcing the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment.
Well, there is some different – there is some unique aspects of this. You know, in the past, courts have dealt rather scrutinizingly toward prayers. For instance, Justice Kennedy wrote the opinion in Lee versus Weissman back in the early 1990s in which the court struck down a prayer given before a high school graduation ceremony using the coercion test. Here he upholds this prayer. And mind you, the court has typically, you know, struck down sort of prayers in school prayer, the prayer in Lee versus Weissman, the prayer before the Friday night public high school football game case. So it's different here in terms of the court actually upholding this prayer. But there's going to be a lot of questions that come out of this. Like the Justice Kennedy uses the Marsh versus Chambers test primarily, in other words, historical traditions. If something historically was present and recognizing the historical presence of religion in society, that's what Marsh versus Chambers does. But he grafts on to that his own coercion test, saying that it can't be that you can have prayer, but it can't be coercive. It can't coerce people in their religious beliefs or religious practices. So he grafts on the coercion coercion test in a way. And another question is going to be, what really makes coercion? Why did a rabbi giving a prayer to a high school graduation, why was that coercive, but this wasn't coercive? Those are questions that have yet to be answered out of this.
So there's still many questions out there regarding the role of religion and, you know, the whole separation of church and state.
There is. And it's a 5-4 decision, of course. We talked about this earlier. We talked about it when the court first took this case, and we kind of talked about the bigger issues involved, of course, that the differences, the different viewpoints about religion. And I think if you wanted to characterize the majority from the dissent, you know, I think the majority looks at religion in a different way in terms of its role within society than does the dissent. And these differing opinions are present not only in the court but in society in general. So that, I think, sort of generates up to the court. But if you're a lawyer or a law professor, you see this case and you see a lot of differences. I mean, one, the court has upheld prayer before. Justice Kennedy struck down prayer with his coercion test. We don't see the endorsement test up till this point. I think one might say that the endorsement test was probably the primary test that the court used to evaluate Establishment Clause cases. Now the court, the Establishment Clause or the endorsement test wasn't here in this opinion.
In Clarence Thomas's writing here, the majority opinion questioned whether the Establishment Clause even applies to state and local governments. Then we're getting to a whole different argument there.
Well, Justice Thomas has made this argument before. It comes out to be a very sort of difficult argument to sum up quickly. He essentially says that it's a structural provision. It's kind of a federalism provision. It applies only to the federal government. It should never have been applied to the state and local governments. He brings back that argument. He's made it before in other cases. This has to deal with incorporation through the 14th Amendment. I won't get into that in great detail. But that issue is probably something the court will never revisit.
Now, the Establishment Clause in the First Amendment, open to interpretation whether it does more than just prohibit Congress from establishing a national religion?
Well, of course, I could ask you, what do you mean by establish and how do you define establishment? And the court, mind you, has never defined establishment. So it has a lot of different tests. I could spend half hour telling you about all the different tests the court has. But it's never defined establishment. It comes up with tests to try to tell us when maybe an establishment has occurred. But that's one of the the problem areas in the Establishment Clause is the courts never really defined for us what really does it mean. Does it mean a national religion like the Church of England that occurred at the time when the First Amendment was ratified? Or does it mean something like a prayer given, you know, at the beginning of a town board meeting? Justice Kennedy, in another case, criticized the endorsement test. He said that it led to a jurisprudence of minutia, that it took us into the very minute, discrete, insular kind of interactions between government and religion, instead of focusing on the big picture, which he claims the Establishment Clause should focus on. In other words, government coercion government religion relationships.
Were there any arguments made by the majority or the minority that you might have found surprising, or did things go pretty much the way you would have expected?
I expected the vote to be what it was. I expected the court to uphold it. And remember, there's also some very practical considerations. For instance, if the court struck down the prayer here, what would the court do with, say, like the prayers at inauguration, or the national motto, or even the salutation given at the beginning of a Supreme Court session, God Save This Honorable Court. The Pledge of Allegiance, a lot of different things like this. Again, looking back, having deep historical roots, what was the court going to do about that if it struck it down? So that's just a very practical matter. I guess what surprised me, it didn't surprise me that the court focused on Marsh versus Chambers because it was so directly involved. What surprised me maybe is that the dissent didn't try to use the endorsement test more than it did.
In talking about the practical applications of a court ruling, is that something that Supreme Court justices keep in mind when they're making their decisions on these, when they're looking at these cases and how they'll rule?
Oh, I think so. But the Establishment Clause, again, is a different type of area because, of course, the court's going to look at that. How is it? In other words, it's when it makes a decision, it wants to give direction to all the lower courts. But the Establishment Clause has just been kind of a real doctrinal nightmare in a way, because the court hasn't been able to give that kind of clear direction, and it hasn't been able to because it just keeps coming up with different tests and different ways to apply those tests. And you've brought out as we've talking now, the ways in which there could still be a lot of litigation over prayer in these kinds of settings, given the kind of, you know, exceptions or parameters that Justice Kennedy put on it.
Well, what do you find most fascinating about these arguments over the role and discussions over the role of religion and government and public life?
Well, I think you have to keep in context probably the way society has changed. The court focuses on history, and the dissent is focusing very much on maybe the future. Looking at what kind of divisiveness could religion play now and in the future? The court itself, in the court's decision, looking back at history, what was our historical purposes in reading the First Amendment really through the lens of history? The dissent is trying to read the First Amendment, I think, through the lens of how our society has changed and evolved. And when you look at it, they do have. I think the dissent is far more conscious of the divisive role that religion could play in society, and looking at Justice Breyer, for instance, in his dissent, saying that the town of Greece really had much more of a duty to make its prayers more inclusive. The court's opinion, on the other hand, tends to look more to history as a more objective guide, and tends not to use the First Amendment in a kind of over-regulatory role, like saying that the First Amendment is going to impose these regulatory duties. In a way, the court itself said, if people are offended, so be it. Just like under the speech clause, you have freedom of speech, and people who are offended by speech can't stop or censor that speech.